This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham.
This hour's schedule, we begin with just about 10 minutes with Virginia's new governor, Terry McAuliffe. Then, about 15 minutes with U.S. Congressman Bob Goodlatte. And then, 20 minutes with U.S. Senator Mark Warner. Got questions for a governor, a congressman, and or a senator? Some feedback you'd like to offer them? You are welcome, of course, to just sit back and listen. Political scientist Bob Roberts is, after all, also here to help us with perspective. But if you're listening to us live on Thursday, January 23rd, you will be invited to join in right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. Here in the Insight studio with me, James Madison University political scientist Bob Roberts. Later in the hour, we meet up with U.S. Congressman Bob Goodlatte, and after that, U.S. Senator Mark Warner. So you might want to make note of our call-in number, 888-967-2825. Easy to remember as 888-WMRA-TALK, especially because our first guest is already on the phone line with us, Governor of Virginia, Terry McAuliffe. Governor, good to be speaking with you again, sir.
Well, it's great to talk to you both, Tom and Bob. Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
So, Governor, now that the General Assembly is in session and you've been sworn into office, what's your top legislative priority? Is it Medicaid or is it something else?
Well, there are a bunch of them, in fairness, but my main issue, which I think about every day and work on every day, is growing and diversifying the economy. I spend at least half my day on the phone calling around the country and the globe trying to figure out ways we can bring businesses here and help it. Now, within that, obviously, you've got to make sure that we're spending the new transportation funding money appropriately, that we're easing congestion and has an economic development component to it and having a local input and say about what roads we're building. But also, obviously, healthcare, bringing back to Virginia our Virginia tax dollars, which, as you know, we are sending to Washington. Whether we take the expansion or not, we are still going to pay these taxes. And you probably have seen the report that just came out. I was briefed on it on Tuesday, that between now and 2022, so for the next 8 years, if we take this money and bring it back and provide health care for up to 400,000 Virginians, we will net, let me remind you, net over $1 billion, which we can then use for other priorities. So obviously this is important to me, but reforming the standards of learning, getting an ethics bill out and signed this year, I think is important, as well as issues related to workforce development, is something I'm really focused on.
Speaking of ethics, what was your response with the announcement earlier this week of the indictment of former Governor McDonnell and his wife on federal corruption charges?
Well, obviously I'm troubled by the charges, that the federal prosecutors have made against the governor and his wife. And the message that this does to the Commonwealth and the message that it sends is the case where it progresses. It's my hope that, obviously justice is going to be served and Virginians get all the answers that they're entitled to. And as governor, I'm focusing on leading the Commonwealth in a way that restores Virginia's trust in government, and honors their expectation of transparency and accountability. I did exactly what I promised I would do. My first day in office, as soon as I walked up the stairs after taking the oath, I signed two executive orders immediately. The first one, no discrimination in the state workplace based on sexual orientation. Number two, I limited myself and my family and my administration to a strict $100 gift ban. Nobody can give anyone in my family, myself, or my administration anything more than $100. It's a very strict, and obviously we have compliance mechanisms. It's an important step in the right direction. So I'm sending a message that, we need full transparency. We got to limit the amount of money that, is in the process right now.
What kind of ethics reform would you like the General Assembly to approve that would affect all elected officials, all government officials in Virginia?
Well, I'd love them if they would follow my lead and do a $100 gift ban, if they'd be willing to do it. I've said that publicly for a long time. I'm not sure they're going to do it. It is a very strict limit. But I have told both the leadership of the House and the Senate, I'm not going to micromanage clearly what they're putting together. Let's get their bills out. And I had breakfast with Senator Norman today and talked about what the Republicans were going to do in the Senate. And as you know, I'd already met with the House leadership, the Republicans in the House, and their bill. So let's get both bills out. Let's have some conversations. But listen, we got to get full transparency back. There's too many gifts being given, and we got to get this money out of it. And if you're an elected office, you are here to be an elected officer, and no one should ever question your motives or intent because someone's been giving you a lot of gifts.
We only have the governor with us for a few more minutes here on Virginia Insight, but we do have a couple of open lines. If you want to try to get your question or comment into him, then you would need to call us right now at 888-WMRA-TALK. We already have some posts on the Virginia Insight Facebook page. And, Governor, this first one from Elizabeth, I'm afraid, is a fairly simple answer, but I'll just ask you what she wrote. Quote, will Virginia be restoring any public support for public radio?
That's a very good question. I'm a huge supporter of public radio, and I would talk to the leadership over in the House and the Senate, and I would support any initiatives. And I'd look into it. I think that's a very good idea. I'm a huge supporter, huge fan of public radio.
See, Governor, I thought that you were going to give us the political realism and say, with the way things are in the General Assembly, that's never going to happen. Tax dollar support for public broadcasting is simply not in the cards.
Well, listen, we've got some opportunities here. If you listen to what I said at the beginning, that if we are smart about bringing this federal money back to us, which is our money, and I remind you, Tom, that 25 states have agreed to take this.
You're talking about Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, but within it, we now have a report from Price Waterhouse, and understand this report was commissioned by the Merck Commission 3-4 months ago. So this report, I had nothing to do with the report, so it just came out, just briefed on it. It frees up over $1 billion, nearly $1.1 billion over the next 8 years. That gives us some money to be able to do other things in addition, using this money to make our healthcare delivery system more effective, more cost efficient. But in addition, some of our priorities, public radio, obviously, pre-K and other things. This is a real game changer for Virginia.
Well, let's, Governor, as long as you mentioned pre-K and as long as we've only got about 2 more minutes with you, we do have Nikki, who's been waiting on hold here, who wants to ask you a question about public education. So if it's okay with you, we're going to put Nikki on the air.
Please.
Nikki from Powhatan, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for Governor Terry McAuliffe, please.
Thank you for having me. I'll try and be quick. I'm interested in the governor's stance on charter schools, particularly in relation to oversight of public dollars spent on for-profit charter schools.
Did you hear that question, Governor?
She was asked about charter schools?
Yeah, and it sounds like she has a concern about taxpayer support for-profit charter schools.
Yes, and also for
Nikki, hold on. Let's have the governor respond. He's having a little trouble hearing you, so I'm translating. Governor, go ahead.
Yeah, listen, I have always said as it comes to education, and listen, I'm fine with charter schools. I'm fine with looking at all different options. I think we have about 3 or 4 charter schools, maybe 5 in Virginia, so it's not a significant amount of schools. I have always said that I am open to looking at any new innovative things that we can be doing as regards to making our education system better. That's why I've talked about pre-K. I talk a lot about SOL reforms. Our teachers are teaching to tests, and our students are learning how to memorize. It's not getting our children to think critically or cognitively. But I'm open to looking at any new creative ideas. I picked Ann Holton to be my Secretary of Education because, you know, Ann has had a lifetime career on these issues, and she will fight for the folks in the margins. And I think that's important. So anything we can do to push ourselves. But listen, we got to make sure that we're investing. I always view public education as an investment, never an expense. I know I need to create jobs. I know that's why people elected me. The only way you can do that is if you have a great pre-K through 12 school system so that you are training the best, our community college system, so that we have the best workforce development. We are training those workers in those 21st century, that would be nanotechnology.
Governor, I apologize for interrupting you, but I realize we only have you for about 30 seconds more, and I just want to ask Nikki for a clarification. Nikki, my sense of your question was that you have a concern about taxpayer money going to for-profit charter schools. Is that part of your question?
Yes, they're going to for-profit charter schools and also going to non-profit charter schools that outsource to for-profit companies.
So, Governor, do you have any
Never should any of our public funds that go to our public schools should be taken away from our public schools. I would adamantly fight. Not a penny should be taken away from our public schools. If anything, we should be investing more in our public schools than what we ought to be doing.
Elected to office last November, but only officially sworn into office a matter of days ago. Well, the 11th of this month. Governor Terry McAuliffe, thank you so very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Bob. Let's do this again.
I was just going to say, come back soon for a full hour.
Okay, great. Love
Thanks.
You.
Take care. We have Congressman Goodlatte who's going to show up on our line soon. So, Peter, in Harrisonburg, I understand that you've got a question that's environment-related and maybe Chesapeake Bay-related. So I'm sorry we didn't have time to put you through to the governor, but if you want to hang on the line there, we might be able to get your question to Congressman Goodlatte. But Bob Roberts, while we're trying to get the congressman on the line, he's traveling somewhere, I think, near Lynchburg today. The entire Virginia congressional delegation, in fact. Well, the entire Congress is on break this week, so almost all members of Congress are traveling through their home areas, meeting with their constituents. Anything in particular strike you about what we just heard from the governor? Of course, he's known for his enthusiasm and his confidence. He just sort of sounds optimistic about getting Medicaid expansion legalized
he's
here.
He's very optimistic about it. But if you look at the response that you've gotten from Republicans today regarding the report of $1 billion, which it's important to explain where that money's coming from. So the listeners, it's not smoke and mirrors. Much of that money is coming from the fact that the state currently subsidizes the state universities at the University of Virginia and VCU and spends huge amounts of money covering unreimbursed care. So much of that $1 billion is coming from the fact that instead of having to use state dollars to cover unreimbursed care, it would be federal dollars.
But as you were about to point out, Republicans remain unconvinced, and most of them in the House of Delegates, which is the all-important body in this debate, are adamantly opposed expanding.
What's interesting,
Medicaid.
Why I was going to ask the governor why they're opposed is not on monetary issues, on moral issues.
So we'll get to more of that a little bit later in the program. But joining us now by phone is the member of the U.S. House of Representatives whose congressional district stretches through much of the Shenandoah Valley, Republican from Roanoke, Bob Goodlatte. Congressman, so good to be speaking with you again, sir.
It's good to be with you and your listeners.
Well, first up, can we talk about ethanol?
Sure, I'd love to talk about Medicaid, too, while you're on that subject.
Well, we'll get back to that then. But I'm just curious, Congressman, am I getting an accurate impression that you may be beginning to think that putting alcohol in our gas tanks is not such a good idea?
Oh, I have not thought that for a long time. But my main concern is with the government interfering with the marketplace. Ironically, this plan to try to create more renewable fuels is actually raising both food prices and fuel prices, since gasoline with ethanol costs more than gasoline without. And the competition of the government mandating that a certain amount of our corn crop and an increasing amount each year has to go into the production of ethanol as opposed to putting food on people's tables is raising food prices by raising the grain costs that agricultural producers in the Shenandoah Valley, people with poultry or beef or dairy production, all of them are facing higher grain costs than they would if they were not having to compete in a marketplace where not only are there people producing ethanol, no objection to that, but the fact that the government is mandating that the fuel industries have to purchase more and more ethanol, even though the demand is not there for that ethanol.
Congressman Goodlatte, am I recalling correctly seeing a press release from your office recently where you are showing some concern even about how ethanol may be affecting the engines in people's cars?
You bet. That is part of a growing coalition that wants to see either the renewable fuel standard repealed or dramatically reformed. And we get complaints all the time from people with various types of small engines, boat motors, lawnmowers, chainsaws, et cetera. But even people with automobiles have lots of complaints, and they blame, some of them rightly or wrongly, on the ethanol, which does not mix well with gasoline and absorbs moisture And that moisture in your tank can cause damage to your engine, particularly smaller engines.
Congressman Bob Goodlatte is also on a tight schedule this afternoon. We've only got about 10 minutes or less with him. We've got some phone lines open if you want to speak with him. Easy way to remember our phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK in all numbers. That's 888-967-2825. Next to Harrisonburg, Peter, thanks for joining in. Your question or comment for the congressman, please.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, my question for the congressman is my concern for the environment are in regard to trying to save the Chesapeake Bay. Are you in favor of controls of runoff from agriculture and urban residential areas? Would you support measures to make those, instead of voluntary, making them mandated by law?
Peter, hold on just a second. I want to check with Congressman Goodlatte. Congressman, we're having a little trouble with Peter's line. Can you hear him okay?
I could hear him, yes.
Okay, you want to respond to the first part of his question?
Sure. Well, first of all, the issue here is whether or not the federal government is abiding by the law. The Clean Water Act, which provides the authority to regulate exactly what he is talking about, says that the federal government gets to set the standards because, after all, water flows across state lines, including through several states, to get to the Chesapeake Bay. And the states, under the Clean Water Act, are allowed to set the standards by which it's met. So the answer is yes, the states already have standards that are met. Some are mandatory, some are voluntary. Now, he may be referring to a new federal government mandate that the states do it their way as opposed to the way they have been doing it. And of course, the way they've been doing it over the last 25 years has resulted in very significant reductions in phosphorus over 40%, nitrogen over 40%, and sedimentation over 50%. Reductions in what flows into the bay. But now the federal government stepped in and said, we're not happy with just setting the standards. We're going to tell the states and farmers and local communities and developers and so on how they have to do this. We think that's a violation of the law. There's a lawsuit pending right now in the courts on that issue. And the Congress also is very concerned that the president is usurping the authority of the Congress when he makes an interpretation of the Clean Water Act that the Clean Water Act doesn't say it does. So that's my concern with it. Now, I have a second concern, and that is in relation to requiring communities and others to gather not sewage water, which obviously needs to be filtered and before it's put into our streams, but storm water running down roads and sidewalks and so on. We have asked for the last 3 years that the Environmental Protection Agency, which is pushing this, that they do a cost-benefit analysis to show that the benefit to the bay, which we all treasure, is very important, is going to exceed the $16-plus billion cost estimate that the state of Virginia estimates all of the communities and farms and others are going to face in having to comply with it. And we're going to see huge increases in water rates and sewer rates and so on and other taxes for communities to be able to pay to capture the water running down the street, filter it before it goes into the streams, before we even know whether that water before it's filtered and after it's filtered is significantly changed enough to justify that enormous cost. So that's my concern about it's not a lack of desire to protect the Chesapeake Bay, but it is a desire to use common sense and cost-benefit analysis and other things that are necessary to make sure that the state government and the federal government are complying with the law and that the law itself makes sense.
Peter, we're so short on time here that I apologize. We're not going to be able to get to a second part of your question. I just want to double check something with you, Congressman Goodlatte. We have had any number of environmental scientists from around Virginia on this show in recent years saying that the newest threat that they see to the bay is the vast expansion of urban development, of big box store parking lots and huge roofs and apartment complexes. Would you support, to take Peter's question a little bit further, some federal study of the impact of that kind of urban development and stormwater runoff?
Absolutely. In fact, that's what we asked for in asking for a cost-benefit analysis. That cost-benefit analysis would measure the impact of stormwater running off of various parking lots and land and lawns of people and so on, determine how much sedimentation and phosphorus and nitrogen is coming from that, and then determining whether or not there is a significant quantity of those things going into the bay with that, and then how much of that would be reduced by collecting, because you can't collect it on every country road, you know, in the state. You're only going to collect it in areas where urban governments are able to impose fees on citizens to pay higher rates to collect it and filter it. And we want to know, is the cost of doing that going to result in a significant improvement in the health of the bay?
Thank you for that clarification, sir.
We've asked for that for years, and they've never provided it.
Congressman Goodlatte, thanks for that clarification. I realize we've only got about three more minutes with you, so let's see if we can fit in one more listener question, by phone at least, from Harrisonburg. We've got Jim. Jim, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please.
Thank you first for taking my question. And Congressman Goodlatte, it's good to talk with you again. I've known you for a long time. But here's my question. I'd like to know what your position is with reference to the identification or the requirement that non-GMO food or GMO foods be identified by labeling.
Genetically sure modified foods is what you're talking about?
Yes, I am.
Okay. We've got some other noise going on in the background that may be yours, Jim, so we're going to go back to Congressman Goodlatte and see what his response is to your question about genetically modified foods.
Well, certainly, two points to be made here. First of all, if food producers think that it is advantageous for them to advise consumers whether or not those ingredients are in foods, they have the right to do that. The question is whether we should mandate it. And I would be opposed to that unless there is a scientific showing that genetically modified foods are different in their impact on the human body than the same food that is not genetically modified. Remember that genetic modification is simply the latest way of hybridizing food. We've had hybridized foods of all kinds for hundreds of years, where you take different species and you may merge them by attaching the branch of one to a tree of another, and you produce a new type of fruit, or you can do that in a variety of different ways. Now we are able to do it with the genes themselves. And you need to have regulation of the production of new foods, but if it is shown that there is no difference between a genetically modified ear of corn and a regular ear of corn or wheat or whatever the case might be and another one, then I don't think you should do it because it's almost impossible to keep them separate in the environment. And we had a major battle with Europe over this issue where they were requiring labeling, and we took them to the World Trade Organization, and they were required to come forward with scientific evidence that showed there was a difference. They could not do it, and the United States won the lawsuit. So I don't want to add enormous new costs to consumers and to the people who produce food for consumers by mandating something that does not result in any appreciable difference. Now, there are many people who have various types of suspicions about different kinds of food, and if they want to look for the type of food that they approve of, they should be able to do that, but I don't believe the government should mandate that anything that contains genetically modified organisms has to be labeled, because the cost is enormous, and every day, virtually every American eats food that contains grains and other food and vegetables and so on that have been genetically modified.
Jim, thanks so much for your question. Congressman Bob Goodlatte, chairman of the U.S. House of Representatives Judiciary Committee, Republican from Virginia's 6th District, covering much of the Shenandoah Valley. Congressman, as always, it's wonderful spending time with you. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Thanks for letting me join you. We'll come back and talk about Medicaid some other time. I side with those Republicans in the House and hope they don't rely on this broken federal government to come up with this money that we don't have and can't afford to spend.
You're tuned to Virginia Insight. We do have some call-in lines still open at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. If you've just joined us, so far this hour, we've spoken with Virginia's new governor, a Democrat, Terry McAuliffe, followed by Virginia longtime congressman from the Shenandoah Valley, a Republican, Bob Goodlatte. And in a few moments, we're going to have on the phone line here another Democrat who actually this is the first time for his ever appearing on Virginia Insight, Virginia's senior U.S. Senator, Mark Warner. But we have our senior political scientist here in the studio while we're waiting to get Senator Warner on the line. Any response to what you heard from Congressman Goodlatte?
Well, absolutely. His last,
can you do it in 60 seconds?
His last statement regarding Medicaid was very interesting. In other words, his position is clearly we don't have the money to spend on it because we have to borrow it, and therefore we shouldn't fund it. The governor's position is it's federal tax dollars going to pay for it. So there's a sharp difference of opinion where this money is coming from.
Well, from the congressman's point of view, he probably doesn't want those federal tax dollars being spent on it, besides the fact that, like most Republicans in the House, right, they are adamantly opposed to anything to do with what they call Obamacare.
Right.
But what you're saying about the governor, the argument that he and other Democrats are making is since those federal tax dollars are being spent, they include federal tax dollars being spent by Virginians, that if Virginians don't get some of that money back as they expand Medicaid, then it's going to other states.
But the congressman is making an argument that these are not federal tax dollars being sent back. That the money we're spending on Medicaid expansion is not tax dollars. They're borrowed dollars. That's his position. In other words, we have no money to pay for Medicaid expansion. The only way we're going to pay for it is to borrow it. The governor saying we have tax dollars that are paying for it. So you have this very sharp difference of opinion how we're paying for Medicaid expansion, which governs how both of them view the issue.
Joining us now by phone is Virginia's senior U.S. Senator, Mark Warner. Senator Warner, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Thank you, guys. And I heard the tail end of that. And the, you know, the interesting thing, if you want to start where you were just left off, is they are both partially right, but you know, where I would differ with my friend Bob Goodlatte is, you know, his critique of the, you know, that the federal Medicaid dollars are borrowed dollars could also be applied to the federal dollars that are spent on Medicare, the Army, highway trust funds. You know,
everything
we are borrowing on you know, virtually any federal expenditure at this point, because we don't have the kind of grand bargain that I've been trying to work for so far, at least unsuccessfully, where we do tax reform, generate some additional revenues, and do entitlement reform, try to bring down some of our out-year costs on entitlements, you know, and get our debt-to-GDP ratio headed in the right direction, you know. Both points are right, but I tend to agree more with the governor and others, and it's not, I think it was a mischaracterization of one of your comments. There are a lot of states that are where Republican governors, including very, very conservative Republican governors, have accepted the Medicaid dollars because they just think it makes common sense that, you know, why should their populations of uninsured be kind of left out when other states are clearly going to be using these federal borrowed dollars.
Senator, I just want to let our audience know, since we have a little bit of a rough cell phone connection with you, that you, like most of the rest of the Virginia congressional delegation, have been traveling around the state this week, that Congress is supposedly on break. I love that term break, because what that means is you all go travel around speaking to your constituents for, you know,
16, 18 hours a day before you go back to Washington.
Right.
But we've caught you traveling, I believe, in a vehicle. We've made sure that you aren't driving, that somebody else is driving you.
Yes, I'm not driving, even though I was a cell phone guy originally. I try to avoid driving and calling at the same time.
But we have you on the phone while you are being driven from, I think, South Boston, Virginia, toward Richmond, Virginia.
Towards Richmond. I'm going to be in Keysville in about 14 miles.
So we're going to try really hard to keep our cell phone connection with you and invite anybody listening to call in and talk to you if they'd like to try to reach us right now at 888-WMRA-TALK. But I'm wondering if I could ask you about marijuana. As you know, President Obama was quoted in a New Yorker magazine piece this week saying that he thinks marijuana is no more dangerous than alcohol. So first of all, I'm wondering what you think the policy implications of a statement like that might be from the President of the United States. And secondly, do you agree with him?
I'm not sure I'm scientifically equipped to make that judgment. How's that for a dodge?
I thought for sure we were going to lose your cell phone signal at that point.
No, I wouldn't be quite that blatant. But here's what I would say. One, I have been surprised at how, as a policymaker, I have been surprised at how quickly public opinion seems to be shifting everywhere in the country on this issue. Point two, as the father of 24, 22, and 19-year-old daughters, I'm really glad that Colorado and Washington states are going to be the first folks to try this different system. And let's wait and see what happens in those states before we make any changes, at least in Virginia.
Okay. We're going to go to the phone lines now, Senator, if that's okay with you. We have a call coming in from Nellisford. Jason, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Senator Mark Webb, please.
Yeah, hi, guys. Hi, Mark. I just wanted to ask you, this kind of relates to your previous statement there, but I'm asking about industrial hemp, which is actually not the same thing as cannabis and the recent stuff that Obama was talking about. But basically, it's 32 states have industrial hemp legislation. I think 20 have passed it. So there's a stumbling block with the federal government in these terms, and they're waiting for that. I was going to ask you, would you co-sponsor the Industrial Hemp Farming Act? I think it's H.R. 525 and Senate 359.
Jason, you can hear there that we have just lost our cell phone connection to Senator Warner as he's traveling the roadways of rural southern Virginia. We're going to try and get him back, and I will do my best to capture the essence of your question and ask him when we get him back with us. Notice I say when, not if.
I appreciate that.
But thank you so very much. You want to fill some time here for us,
sure.
Bob Roberts?
No, I found the
well, there are like 14 different questions I was going to ask, but I'll just let you pick.
The senator's comment regarding the budget very interesting because Senator Warner has focused heavily during his 6 years in the Senate on a grand compromise. And the grand compromise would be to make major changes in entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, and at the same time raise additional revenue. And he has worked very, very hard doing that. The problem is he hasn't gotten much support from Republicans to enter in that grand bargain, which leads to the situation where, as he explained with Medicaid and all federal programs, a certain amount of funding for every single federal program right now is borrowed money. And therefore, that is what he's focused on. I think probably to his consternation, he has not made as much progress as he had hoped to make on the idea of dealing with these much larger macro budget issues. And I think that's probably very discouraging to him in terms of not being able to deal with those macro issues. And I'm sure he doesn't know how to deal with marijuana as an issue in terms of which is a complex issue. In other words, should Virginia follow the precedent of
And you said precedent, as in legal precedent, not president, as in the guy who earlier this week made this surprising statement.
And I don't disagree with Obama's argument. I think you can make an argument, and I think what the president was trying to say is, alcohol is really bad for people. A lot of people are really addicted to alcohol. Has a lot more social consequences to it. We legalize it. Why do
a disastrous experiment
with making
it illegal that only lasted for a few years, having marijuana illegal has been an experiment that's gone on for, 80 years?
And the consequences for marijuana making it illegal has been greater because a significant number of people have been put in jail for drug distribution, who are incarcerated for lengthy periods of time. And we don't do that for people who are selling alcohol legally, or moonshiners. Let's say you're moonshining, and we have moonshiners in this area. And if they're moonshining and distributing moonshine, they're not put in jail for 20 years. They simply aren't. So in a sense, we treat the illegal distribution of alcohol, which is just as serious as a consequence of marijuana, much differently than we treat the illegal raising and distribution of marijuana. Why? Why would we? Moonshining is even glamorized. We have a TV series that glamorizes the production of moonshine, and that TV series is filmed in Virginia, part of Virginia. So it's interesting. I think that's the point the president was trying to make. Why do we treat the two substances so differently?
I think that's a question lots of people have been asking for some time now.
Yeah.
But the political will to even discuss the possibility of making a change has been absent from most people who ever think they're going to run for an election again.
Yeah, because
the first person to talk about this extensively who was a major national figure was George Shultz, the former Secretary of State for Ronald Reagan after he left office. President Obama, now these decades later, talking about it, knowing he's never going to have to run for office again. And you have Senator Warner sort of jokingly saying, it's a dodge here. I'm not going to fully get into this issue, but also noting that he is sometimes surprised at how fast public opinion changes.
Among young voters, this issue is an important issue. College-age students, they don't understand why. When I was growing up in the 60s,
can you hold that thought?
Sure.
Because while we have been talking,
yes,
our crack line producers in the control room have connected with Senator Warner's cell phone three times in the past few minutes and lost the signal again.
No, I'm back.
We now have the fourth time, and I think, we have evidence that we actually have a more secure connection.
I do feel at times a little guilty that I made a fortune off of technology that still doesn't work all across Virginia.
I wasn't going to ask you about that.
No, it was all right. And let the callers note that even though you guys thought that I might just try to drop the call when you raised this subject, I did call back three times.
Very good.
You did.
Well,
and Senator Warner, when we first lost the connection there, we had Jason asking a question about a cousin of marijuana, but industrial hemp, by most experts' standards, is not something that has enough of the, what I guess you might call the good stuff in it, that anybody would be able to use it to make drugs out of it. But it is thought to be useful for any number of industrial products. And Jason's question was, how would you feel about supporting legislation now in Congress that would go back to legalizing the production of industrial hemp across the country? And I think there's actually the Industrial Hemp Farming Act is Senate Bill 359. Don't know if you knew that or not.
Well, let me the one thing I've learned in my 5 years in the Congress is there's a lot of bills on a lot of topics, and weighing in when you don't have all the facts is probably not the smartest thing. I've heard some of the arguments about industrial hemp. I think my understanding is you're right. It doesn't have the same THC content that medicinal or other marijuana is used. I guess the question, and I probably dropped when when
Jason,
this part of my answer I was trying to give, and I don't mean to be glib on this, and I do acknowledge that, you know, that people's views on this is changing, but I also have to say, as a policymaker, but as a father of daughters that are 24, 22, and 19, I'm actually glad in a way that Colorado and Washington State are going first.
And we did get your response on that part of the question.
I genuinely mean, you know, I would, you know.
But as far as Jason's question about industrial hemp, something different than marijuana.
Right.
It sounds like what you're saying is at this point you don't have enough information to make a stand.
In the age of digital, what you say will be used forever, and I would just I'd rather get my back straight on that before I know. I mean, at the first blush, there seems as you said that it's used for other products, and I believe there are certain states even beyond those who legalize marijuana have used industrial hemp. But again, I don't know enough to give you a definitive yes or no.
Okay, so let's move on to another topic that you may end up wishing that your cell phone drops out again. But we got to ask you about that. That Virginia's new attorney general, elected by the slightest of margins after a recount, Mark Herring, announced today that he's taking his support for same-sex marriage kind of to a new level. He is refusing to try to enforce in court Virginia's ban against same-sex marriage, which means, among other things, that a court case that's been going on here in the Shenandoah Valley, a lesbian couple in Winchester and a lesbian couple in Stanton have filed against the Virginia ban on same-sex marriage, that case being heard in federal court in Harrisonburg by a federal judge who is an Obama appointee. So it's thought that there may be some support for going forward with this case. And in fact, the judge has already declined to dismiss the case. All that leading up to now the attorney general saying the state is no longer going to contest against these types of cases. What's your feeling on allowing same-sex marriage to be legal?
Listen, this is an issue that, I think people have moved faster than elected officials. I announced my support last year for the marriage equality provisions. I had not been, again, probably as much affected by questions from my daughters as anything that kind of said that why, I've been against Virginia's constitutional prohibition and I've been very supportive of non-discrimination, but I moved towards marriage equality and support that. I do think the question of what the Attorney General is doing, this is a precedent that was actually, I believe, started by Attorney General Puccinelli when, because he felt strongly vis-a-vis Governor McDonald's, one of Governor McDonald's education reforms, he chose not to, represent the Commonwealth in that proceeding. Now, I think Attorney General Herring is making that same decision in terms of his beliefs, as we've seen as recently as that case in Utah. This is again the one that seems to be both at the kind of in the minds of Americans and the minds of lawmakers, and obviously in the minds of judges, is a very fluid circumstance.
But I think that we're hearing fairly clearly from you, Senator Warner, that you think moving towards what you call marriage equality, in other words, allowing both heterosexual and homosexual couples to get married, is the direction that you think we should be going.
I believe that giving folks, same-sex couples, the same legal rights as I've got in my marriage is, where America, and I think society is moving.
And I want to try and squeeze in one more question here on a completely different topic before you have to go, hoping that your cell phone signal is going to stay with
really,
us.
Really, I mean, and I thought, you know, and I thought these questions were going to be all Obamacare. I would have never thought of one if I was pushing for Obamacare.
Actually, this next one isn't even close. It's because I understand that when you were in Charlottesville at a town hall meeting at UVA earlier this week, the whole issue of student loans and student debt came up, and you made what struck me as from some fairly strong comments on how you think this is affecting our economy. So tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah, I was very lucky, you know, to do well in business, and some Virginians know that. What probably most Virginians may not know was my first two business ventures failed miserably. And, you know, I was flat broke. But I came out of college as the first person in my family to graduate from college and law school with about $15,000, $20,000 worth of debt. So I was able to fail twice. And I had debt, but I didn't have that overhang of a lot of the students now, $100,000, $200,000 worth of debt. And I really wonder whether I would have had that same willingness to take those kind of risks as a young person where most entrepreneurs start, if I had the kind of debt burden that many of the students are coming out with. And I do believe that, you know, coming to an economy near you soon, the next financial crisis we're going to face is this student debt explosion, over $1 trillion in student debt. I frankly think we've kind of made a, you know, higher education, I'm a huge supporter of higher education, but I believe there's kind of been a pact made where we're not looking at output and accountability from some of our higher educational institutions. And the way we've been able to kind of ignore that and not kept price with student grants is that we've simply levered up through enormous, much more free-flowing debt, again, oftentimes backed by the federal government, that has allowed these escalating prices, but I'm not sure all students are getting the full value. Where do we go? And I know that the president has stirred the pot a little bit on this. And I've had a lot of our colleges and universities raise a lot of concern with me. And, you know, I do think they're, you know, we want to make sure we don't box people out in that college from taking the marginal student. But I think this is a debate that we got to have.
Somehow
tying in educational institutions, you know, aligning their interests with students down the line, having productive, gainful employment, you know, somehow that we gotta wrestle with this.
He is, of
course. I don't have a 3-point plan to answer it yet, but this is an issue that's not going to go away. I got, you know, in this trip, I bet I got more questions on this issue than Obamacare. And this is not just in Charlottesville. This is across Southside Virginia, which really surprised me.
Senator, I want to thank you so very much for engaging in this experiment with us, putting you on your cell phone, talking to us while you're being driven through rural Virginia. It's a delight talking to you, but I hope that we can get you back sometime soon, either in studio or at least on a landline.
You got it, guys.
Thank you.
He is, of course, a former Democratic governor of Virginia, but since 2009 has been representing the Commonwealth in the United States Senate, Senator Mark Warner. Thank you so very much for your time.
Take care.
You probably would love to talk about student debt, but before we get there, in case we run out of time, I got to get back to this debate over same-sex marriage.
Right.
And the fact that Mark Herron, elected by, what, less than a tenth of a percent of the vote,
is doing this,
has stirred the pot hugely on a social issue by saying that he is not going to enforce Virginia's Defense Against Marriage Act.
Yeah,
that he is, in
it's
essence...
More than that. He said more than that. What he said was he's going to file briefs
supporting those
to overturn a Virginia constitutional amendment.
Which would seem to make it likely that same-sex marriage is coming to Virginia.
It makes it more likely that a federal judge, if he sees that the attorney general can't support a constitutional amendment ratified for your own voters, might find that a persuasive argument. I'm not saying the federal judge will, but it increases the likelihood that the federal judge will say if the attorney general of the state cannot support this amendment, there must be grounds to overturn it.
So we talked a little bit about this a couple of weeks ago, yeah. Bob. You raised this issue even before Mr. Herring was sworn into office.
Yeah.
The fact that there was this case going on in the Shenandoah Valley with two lesbian couples. There also is another case going on in the Norfolk area with a gay couple challenging Virginia's law, saying that marriage can only be between a man and a woman. And your thought was that if anybody wins at the federal district court level, that's likely to mean a huge difference in Virginia because the attorney general would not take it to the Supreme Court.
And Mr. Gilbert, who's a delegate from Shenandoah County, because of exactly this, what Herring was apparently going to do, he must have been leaked or something, has submitted legislation to give the General Assembly standing to challenge any decision, even though the attorney general doesn't. And in a sense,
but the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled in the past, you told us last time, that only a state's attorney general has standing to take this.
Currently in the U.S. Constitution, under the Virginia Constitution, they do. He does. But Gilbert argues if the legislature gives, it can give itself standing. I disagree. I think that violates the separation of powers doctrine.
But that certainly gives a new reason to have this case go towards the Supreme Court.
And I've had colleagues of mine saying, you know.
But as of a few weeks ago, who thought that we could be this close to same-sex marriage becoming legal in Virginia?
This issue was discussed during the campaign. It did not get a lot of attention in terms of the two positions of the two candidates running for attorney general.
Well, we've got more to talk about again soon, hopefully with fewer cell phone problems. Our guests have been early in the hour, Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, 6th District Virginia Congressman Bob Goodlatte, and Virginia's senior U.S. Senator Mark Warner. Plus, throughout the hour, political scientist from James Madison University, Bob Roberts. Thanks so much for making time for us. You can find postings of Virginia Insight on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. And when you get to the page for today's broadcast, you will find links to more information about all of our guests, including contact information for them. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.